you don't really understand sometimes what a terrible burden it is to know some of the things that I know and try to wake people up and impart this knowledge to them and find out that they just have walls built in front of them. They want to be slaves. But we're making some chinks in those walls.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Even after the Snowden revelations, Microsoft, Facebook and the rest have failed to fight back for our privacy. So whose side are they on? Legal challenges to the spooks who are obsessed with knowing all our passwords and cracking all our antivirus software and our encryption, like we are the enemy. The Internet Freedom Campaign, the Open Rights Group, are in Bristol next Thursday. Yes, it's the Open Rights Group comes to town and we hear what it's all about from their executive director. Also, Ukraine hots up with armed groups taking over many cities in eastern part of the country and smaller towns too. May's elections are looming though and ethnic Russians look like they don't trust Kiev to play fair in those elections. Just how far right is that new Kiev government and why is Nick Clegg and the EU so enthusiastic for them if they are? Plus, an extended interview this week with Britain's top media rights campaigner, really number one. He's Granville Williams. He's also an author about who owns the media. And he brings us up to speed with who owns Britain's media today, how it's all being affected by the internet giants, the titans, he calls them, like Microsoft, Google, Facebook and Twitter. But before all that, let's go to Ukraine, Martin. And we've seen quite a lot of changes over the last couple of weeks. We were off the air last week when I was at the NUJ conference. But we've seen occupations now, haven't we? Armed gangs occupying large areas of the east of the country, particularly the east and the southeast of Ukraine. Now, the obvious question to ask is, are the Russians behind this?
I think not directly. I mean, the question...
It's indirectly, then?
Well, I mean, Victoria Nuland, who was the US ambassador, I believe, in Kiev, was openly said, we've spent $5 billion in the last several years to remove the current government.
Openly said? Or was
well,
that...
no, she said it on a telephone, which was then intercepted. So the West, the Maidan protesters that pushed out the Yanukovych government, many of them were being paid. I mean, they're people like us, if you like, but we're not paid for doing this, Tony. They were paid for creating alternative media, criticising the government, etc. All paid for by Western tax dollars. So if the Russians were paying these people to take over places in the East, all they would be doing is exactly the same as what CIA, MI6 were doing before the coup. I don't think that is the case. I think one of the problems with this situation is that Putin isn't really in control on the ground in the East Ukraine, and nor is anybody else. And the potential for conflict between those who are pro the current government and those who are against the current government is very definitely there. I imagine that communities are split, pretty much as they were in Belfast in 1969 or Bosnia in 1992. And the danger is that people start killing each other out of an excess of zeal for their own political cause, and then the superpowers on both sides will be dragged in to try and help their protégés. If the West is really in control of their side, as it were, and Putin's in control of his people, and on a positive note, I would say that there was a joint statement issued in Geneva yesterday where they all agreed on the steps needed to go forward, which was that all armed groups from both sides should put down their weapons and that everybody should do things the proper way through political struggle. Now, it's good that everybody's agreed that, but I wonder whether it's going to stick because, of course, people have already been killed on both sides. Passions are running high. It may be very difficult for anybody to control the situation, pretty much like Sarajevo in 1914, when somebody comes out and shoots the Archduke Ferdinand and everybody ends up going to war, not because they want to, but because everybody's agreed that they're going to do X, Y and Z if that happens, and nobody knows how to stop it.
Now, your book, what was the title of it?
Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle.
Now, in that, you talked about Ukraine. You were pointing towards Ukraine as a potential real civil war there, because it had both Western and Russian influences in it. Now, can you just compare that to what happened in the former Yugoslavia back in the late 1990s? Because we have seen, I think, what is a quite a similar situation. A former Eastern European republic, or a former Eastern European country, which was under a Soviet influence, suddenly what happens is the Soviet influence is fading away. I mean, obviously, that's not suddenly in Ukraine. That's been happening for many years now. But then what started to happen in Yugoslavia was that the country started to fracture into little republics, traditional places which had been historically their own, had their own traditions. Are we going to see something, do you think, similar happening with Ukraine, with various regions splitting off from Kiev?
That is obviously the danger. Obviously the two situations aren't directly comparable. Situations never are, but of course any situation, the precedents set in previous situations tend to work.
We've got a very similar situation, haven't we, when Kosovo split off from Yugoslavia, Yugoslav capital, Belgrade, they were saying, well, this is terrible, you know, we can't allow this. They're saying exactly the same sort of thing to Donetsk now, and they were saying the same to Crimea
in Yugoslavia, in theory, the existing, it was a federal system, so the existing states could break away, a bit like if Scotland broke away from England, the border will be the same as it was in 1707. Yeah, but of course, in Northern Ireland, of course, the border is a much more problematic thing, because it wasn't drawn on the basis of existing boundaries.
But if we can stick with Yugoslavia and the comparison over there, what happened in Yugoslavia, and what can we learn
I'll briefly summarise what.
Because you were there.
I was in Yugoslavia in the 90s. The book came out in 1998, and I predicted that what would happen in Ukraine was very similar to what had happened in Yugoslavia. The first thing that happened, of course, is you've got market. Marketization, privatization, liberalization. So the existing structure is subjected to a shock, radical change. Now, the problem with that is that there are winners and losers, and you've usually got a kind of economic development gradient in a society. So in Yugoslavia, the most developed republics, Slovenia and Croatia, were in the north, and the least developed republics were in the south, Kosovo, parts of Serbia, Macedonia. Although Kosovo wasn't, in fact, an independent republic under the communist regime, it was an autonomous region as part of Serbia. Now, in other words, these were all arrangements that had been made within the Yugoslav League of Communists about who was going to deal with what. And Crimea was only placed inside the Ukraine, which was, they were all part of the same country, the Soviet Union, by Khrushchev in 1954. Some say because he was drunk. I don't know whether that's true, but partly it was because he wanted to undermine the position of the West Ukraine, which tended to be more hostile to Soviet power. The West Ukraine and the Ukrainian nationalists who are now in the current government, their grandfathers fought in the SS, and in actual fact, many of them are wearing symbols. If you look at the protesters, they're all wearing this symbol, which was the symbol of the Ukrainian SS division. Now, of course, that is red rag to bull for the pro-Soviet people. There was a Kosovan Muslim SS division. So what happens is the Germans, I mean, a lot of wars are created through history. The Germans basically manipulated the various ethnic groups in Yugoslavia and in the Ukraine to suit their purposes. Then they were defeated and driven out. But the hatred created by that manipulation remains. And So the decision by Yanukovych to sign for what the Russians were offering was because he was being put in an impossible position, where the EU and the IMF were saying, we want you to sign up to this, which would involve, for example, mass redundancies in the east of the Ukraine. And that's where his power base is. He said, well, I'm not going to do that. And he refused to sign up for it. And he was the elected leader, however corrupt he may be. They're all corrupt. Timoshenko's just come out of prison, and she's going to run for president. Presumably she was in prison for a reason. They're all corrupt. So that's really not the issue. It's not corruption versus non-corruption. The oligarchy control all of the politics in Ukraine, and they have done ever since the changes began.
Okay, well, we're going to hear now from some of the main players. There's Rasmussen, who's the Secretary General of NATO currently, and also from Putin after that. But let's have Rasmussen first, and this is a statement he made on Wednesday. So events have gone a little bit past, but this is what he had to say then.
We have just taken further measures to respond to the crisis in Ukraine. We agree that a political solution is the only way forward. NATO fully supports the Geneva talks and all the efforts of the international community to find a political solution which fulfills the democratic aspirations of the entire Ukrainian people and respects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. We call on Russia to be part of the solution, to stop destabilizing Ukraine, pull back its troops from the borders, and make clear it doesn't support the violent actions of well-armed militias of pro-Russian separatists. NATO's core task is to protect and defend our allies. We have already taken a series of steps, including enhancing our air policing mission in the Baltic states and AWACS surveillance flights over Poland and Romania. Today, we agreed on a package of further military measures to reinforce our collective defense and demonstrate the strength of Allied solidarity. We will have more planes in the air, more ships on the water, and more readiness on the land. For example, air policing aircraft will fly more sorties over the Baltic region. Allied ships will deploy to the Baltic Sea, the Eastern Mediterranean, and elsewhere as required. Military staff from allied nations will deploy to enhance our preparedness, training, and exercises. Our defense plans will be reviewed and reinforced. We will start to implement these measures straight away. More will follow, if needed, in the weeks and months to come.
That was Anders Fogh Rasmussen. He's the Secretary General of NATO. Martin, really what he's saying there is, look, you know, we've got to be on the cautious side here. We're going to make sure that we beef up our presence all around the western fringes of Ukraine. We're not going into Ukraine ourselves, personally, but we are going to make sure we beef up our presence by land, sea and air. That is also, we've also heard this week, haven't we, about the guided missile destroyer that's come into the Red Sea as well.
Not the Red Sea,
sorry,
the Black Sea.
The Black Sea. Well, let's hope it's not red anyway. No, the Black Sea, which has violated something called the Montreux Treaty, which the Russians are very unhappy about. This is a treaty which has been long-standing about the Russian fleets and the American fleets' presence right on the Russian border. So they're obviously ramping it up. But what do you think about what the Secretary General had to say there?
All right, well, what I said on Russia Today, not this Monday but last Monday, was let's go back to the beginning of this whole crisis, the removal of Yanukovych and the takeover of the new regime in Kiev. Now, what happened in the morning of that takeover was a deal was being discussed between three representatives of the EU and all the various political factions within Kiev. And they had agreed that they were going to have an early election and a government of national unity, and they were going to change the powers of the president. As they left that meeting, snipers then shot up to 80 to 100 people, both Berkut police, riot police, and protesters. And there's a leaked phone call, which was presumably bugged by somebody, between Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign representative, and Umas Piets, who is the Estonian foreign minister. And in that, Piets says to Ashton, I've just been to the hospitals, going round. What the doctors are telling me is that everybody has been shot in the same way, with the same bullets, by the same snipers, in the same in the head, and what the doctors are saying is that the snipers are connected not with the Yanukovych regime, but with the current regime. And the word on the street, it was a Ukrainian nationalist formation called UNA-UNSO.
Well, there is also there were reports in the Ukrainian press at the time that actually it was British rifles that were used and British
Indeed.
Bullets.
Indeed, British rifles and British bullets, dear listeners. Now, Piets has admitted that the phone call is genuine. So what we know, what the world knows, is that there is prima facie evidence that the shootings in the Maidan Square were carried out by the current regime. Now, what, to my mind, what you've got to remember, these far-right groups in the Ukraine have had a long-standing relationship with NATO intelligence services, people like the CIA and MI6.
Well, actually, NATO intelligence ran their own fascist groups, didn't they? So they
did.
Friendly with some of these neo-Nazis.
Well, exactly. The Gladio networks, which were set up in Western Europe from the 1940s onwards, that very much used fascist and ex-fascist personnel. And, of course, these Gladio networks, which were related to Reinhard Gehlen, who became the head of the West German BND, the secret police there. He was the head of Gestapo in Eastern Europe during the 40s. And, of course, he had strong links with these far-right Ukrainian groups. So I suggest that the far-right Ukrainian groups which carried out the shootings in the Maidan, mostly of the ordinary protesters and the ordinary police officers, their links with NATO intelligence services like the BND, like MI6, like the CIA, is long-standing, and they wouldn't have just done this on their own. Now, in other words, it's NATO that's trying to provoke a war here. And NATO is not a defensive alliance. And it's certainly not perceived as a defensive alliance in Russia. But if it was NATO intelligence services working with the fascists that killed all these people, that could solve a problem for this of civil war. Because the ordinary folk in the West Ukraine, the people who are pro the current government, if they realise that that government is the people who shot their relatives, then maybe this government will go. And if this government is taken out, then maybe we can find a political solution that's acceptable to everybody, which leaves Ukraine independent, both of NATO and of Russia.
But you, when you did that piece on the international TV, Martin, you were talking about the similarities with Venezuela and Syria.
Oh, yes,
what did you mean by that?
Well, what happened in the coup in Venezuela against Chavez in 2002, and also in Syria in the recent uprising there several years ago, you've got protesters protesting against the government. They don't like the government. That happens. Of course it does. The police are policing the protests. So if we go into the streets against the government here, the police will police the process. It's all normal stuff. There shouldn't be any reason for anybody to get upset. But at a certain stage of the game, mysterious snipers appeared in both Venezuela, in Caracas, and in Syria, in Damascus, and in Homs, shooting both protesters and police, the purpose being to try and stir up the pot so that you can then create a kind of hysterical situation where a takeover of power, Assad's got to go, Yanukovych has got to go, Chavez has got to go, they've killed their own people, isn't it terrible? But in actual fact, this is a NATO standard operating procedure. These Gladio structures, it's been exposed for years, people can look this up, just go to your computer and use Google or any other search engine, you will find that police action has uncovered the fact of what happened. Imposimato is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, has written a book about all of this, which came out in 2012, where he said, and it's based on police investigations in Italy, it's quite clear that all the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, both by the left and the right, was being orchestrated by NATO intelligence services, basically to keep the Communist Party out of power. So NATO has got a track record of shooting protesters and police in order to try and change regimes.
It's all very well to talk about this stuff happening abroad, but we had recently the anniversary of the death of PC Yvonne Fletcher. Now, that was very controversial, but there was a two-part dispatches programme called Murder in St. James, which took a very close look at the ballistics of Yvonne Fletcher's murder, and they proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that she could not possibly have been shot from the Libyan embassy due to the angle of the bullet which went through her body. That was traced to a high-up building which had actually been rented previously, up in the week previously, to the security services. Now, that suggests that there may have been a provocation by our own side in order to blame the Libyans for killing a police officer. Now, this was part of the Gladio really playbook, wasn't it? That actually in Europe, many police stations were attacked, police officers were killed by the army, and this was all then blamed on whoever it was they wanted
when
to
you
blame.
When you say the army, what it is you've got these units which are secret units. So the joint services group inside the Green Zone in Iraq, which is run by Brigadier Gordon Kerr. Now, he is still wanted, I understand, by the police in this country for running the Loyalist terror campaign. So what you've got is NATO intelligence service has got a track record of carrying out terrorism and blaming it on their enemies. Now, they're not the only people who do this. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Putin and Berezovsky bombed Moscow in 1999, blamed it on the Chechens to get Putin elected. But, of course, the West at the time was happy for that to happen because it got rid of the danger of Zyuganov and the Communist Party winning the election in November 1999. So it's not just NATO intelligence services that engage in these provocations, but I think in this case, with Umas Piets pointing the finger directly at NATO, I think NATO probably killed those people. Now, the ordinary folk in Ukraine and the world need to get this. That's who did it.
Okay, well, we'll see. Well, that in the future, I mean, I understand why you think that, what you did, Martin. But anyway, let's go now. And you mentioned the surveillance, that phone call. And we had a bit of a surprise guest when Putin was discussing the other day what was happening in Ukraine at his annual press conference, question and answer session with members of the public and the press, because who was to pop up but Edward Snowden, and asked him some questions about just what sort of surveillance that the Russians were doing, which is rather a wonderful moment. But anyway, here is Vladimir Putin, followed by a question from Edward Snowden.
I can remind you that Russia's Federation Council granted the President the right to use armed forces in Ukraine. I very much hope that I will not have to use that right and that we will be able to solve all current burning issues in Ukraine by political and diplomatic means. Can a compromise be found on the Ukrainian issue between the United States and Russia? The compromise must be found not between third-party players, but between different political forces within Ukraine itself. This is the key point.
I'd like to ask you a question about the mass surveillance. Does Russia intercept, store, or analyze in any way the communications of millions of individuals?
Mr. Snowden, you are a former agent, and in the past I had something to do with intelligence. So we will talk between ourselves as professionals.
Okay, so Putin's keeping shtum on whether he's doing what the NSA were doing, and I would imagine the answer is probably yes, Martin, that Vladimir Putin and the Russian secret services are doing something similar to what the NSA are doing. No,
well, what Putin actually said was, no, we're not doing mass surveillance. Because, of course,
he said, I'll talk to you afterwards about it.
Yeah, but what you are doing, of course, if the NATO special forces are involved in shooting protesters in the Maidan Square, you're definitely bugging their phones. What Snowden's complaining about, and don't forget he's a Republican voter from the right of US politics, is you can't just go on fishing expeditions and look at everybody's stuff. That's what the Stasi used to do in East Germany and so on. If you are an anti-terrorist police officer, you've got an absolute right, with the judges say so, to bug somebody's phone if you suspect they're up to something. And, of course, what they've found by bugging Catherine Ashton's phone and Umas Piets' phone call is that, in actual fact, they've pointed the finger for the shootings in the Maidan firmly at UNA-UNSO, which is a far-right group within the Ukrainian government, and also with strong links to NATO intelligence services. The Russians have played a blinder there because they pointed the finger exactly where it probably should be pointed.
Now, finally then, Martin, in a month's time, what's it going to look like in Ukraine? Which direction is this heading? I mean, we hear today, don't we, that the Ukraine separatists have actually rejected this deal that's supposedly done in Geneva. They're saying today that they were not bound by an international deal ordering them to disarm or would not move out of public buildings they've seized. The agreement, which was brokered by the US, Russia and Ukraine, according to Reuters today, and the EU in Geneva yesterday, seemed to be the best hope of defusing the standoff. Ukraine's acting president and prime minister offered some of the strongest pledges yet to strengthen constitutional rights to use the Russian language, which was one of the things that they were most annoyed about. Initially, the new government said they wouldn't be allowed to, and to defuse the protest, but Kiev said its efforts to root out the separatists would continue. The Geneva Agreement requires all illegal armed groups to disarm and end occupations of public buildings, streets and squares, but with separatists staying put in the east and Ukrainian nationalist protesters showing no sign of leaving their unarmed camps in the capital's Maidan Square, was not clear that either side would be willing to move first. So, Martin, what's going to happen over the next month?
Well, you've got a situation where the extremists on both sides who are armed are being told that they'll have to disarm by their various protégés, but they're not necessarily going to do so. I mean, these fascist groups in the Ukraine, and they've got a lot of support. They're not just small criminal groups. They have a lot of support, a bit like Ulster Loyalists or white South Africans.
Well, I can remember war memorial service a couple of years ago seeing footage of young fascists throwing half bricks at these octogenarians, people that have fought in the Second World War.
Indeed. So, in other words, the Russians will say, and the protesters in the east will say, we're prepared to back down and take our weapons away and stop occupying buildings if your people will back down in Lviv and stop occupying buildings and hand in their weapons. Now, in actual fact, the far right in Ukraine has got no intention of handing its weapons over whatsoever. And under those circumstances, the nationalist left, if you want to call it that, in the East Ukraine isn't going to hand over its weapons either. That's a very dangerous situation. But there's no reason for fighting if everybody's calm. There's still possibility to resolve this through political means, and they've come to some agreement in Geneva is relatively hopeful, because of course the West can't really afford to have sanctions on Russia. It'll crash the US stock market, and that'll be the end of that.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, legal challenges to the spooks, who seem obsessed about knowing our passwords and cracking our antivirus software and encryption. Well, it's just like we're the enemy. And Internet Freedom Campaign, the Open Rights Group, are coming to Bristol next Thursday evening. And they will be at the St. Werburgh's Community Centre, at least one of their lawyers will, around about 8 p.m. Thursday, April the 24th. But to find out why they're coming, I spoke to Jim Killock, who's the Executive Director of the Open Rights Group, earlier this week.
Yes, so we're a digital rights campaign, so we are campaigning about the effects, positive and negative, of the digital age, and we want the benefits of the digital age to flow to individuals. And we're most worried about the attacks on people's rights that have come as a result of digital technology, because while we are benefiting from this technology for free speech, we can say lots of things, publish as we like. At the same time, there are plenty of people who want to use the internet as a way to take our information and surveil us, or use that information for commercial purposes and track us around the internet, not necessarily with our permission. And equally, governments want to surveil us, and lots of politicians, of course, want to censor the internet. They're threatened by the benefits. They're worried about the effects of the internet, and they want to control the technology.
Now, what evidence do you have that government are actually threatened by the internet, then?
Well, they feel threatened. I mean, I think that this is the key. They're not perhaps threatened in reality, but I think lots of politicians, it's very clear, feel threatened. And you see this with politicians demanding that we have internet filtering, with copyright companies demanding ways to shut down websites or to block them on internet service providers' networks. So lots of people want to stop information from being available, or at least attempt to do that. I mean, we've got a debate at the moment about extremism too. There are government has silently censored extremist material, some of which may be illegal, some of which may not, on their own networks, and they want this secret list of banned material to be pushed out to domestic internet service providers and work internet filters and so on. So there's plenty of quite surreptitious attempts to control information in this kind of way.
Now, I can remember towards the end of last year, we were told about David Cameron wanted to introduce a filter, online filter, for child abuse images. I mean, what can possibly be wrong with that?
Well, we already have such a filter, actually, and we have for many years. And the problem with that, I mean, is the lack of transparency. And we've seen particularly sites like WordPress in recent months being constantly having their technology broken and people not really knowing why they can't access WordPress administration sites. And the reason is this secret blacklist of child abuse images has been implemented in such a way as it's screwing up WordPress's site, basically. So that's happened before. It happened with Wikipedia as well. So I think on a simple level, there is a problem that often they don't have the intent, you know, they have unintended consequences and things go wrong. But I think there's also, to be honest, a sort of a deeper problem that we find the politicians always looking to the internet companies to provide answers, and they push at the internet companies, whether it's Google, and saying, you know, we want you to censor your filter. To result, you know, filter your internet search results, or whether they're saying to ISPs that they want them to ban things, whatever it is, it's always somebody else's problem. But, you know, child abuse is a very, very serious crime, and pretending that you're making serious inroads into that by banning search terms that nobody uses, or blocking websites that nobody is going to visit in that way, you know, it's and then claiming serious results, you know, that's really pretty manipulative.
But
it's
a
way of distracting, I think, from the real problem.
Do you have any examples of where perfectly legitimate material has been captured by this internet filter?
So we must be a little bit clear. The two kinds of filtering that we know about going on at the moment, one is the secret list of child abuse material, and we know Wikipedia got partially blocked, editors got blocked, and as I say, WordPress has got their administration sites blocked on TalkTalk specifically as a result of this filtering. With the wider filtering of pornography, this is a slightly different issue. This is about children being discouraged from accessing legal for adult content. That's to say, pornography, maybe gambling sites, that kind of material. Those filters are much, much wider. They're classifying huge parts of the internet. And that happens on mobile phones today, and it's David Cameron's ambition that he persuades as many people as possible to switch these on at home as well. And that's where we get a problem, because then you do get lots and lots of websites swept up into this. And yeah, we've had a site called blocked.org.uk running for a couple of years now, and we regularly collect examples of blogs, churches, at one time a lot of sites that were selling alcohol were getting blocked because alcohol can't be sold to people under 18, so it was in the filters. And none of this is very necessary. And some of it is just simply mistakes. The churches, you know, they had the word wine in their titles and so on. And it was the name of a network, you know, wine was alcohol, and that got there, you know, no suitable for under 18s, and therefore got them on the block list. So filters are extremely crude. They will block far more than is necessary. LGBT groups have been extremely worried about this as well, because they've frequently got their sites swept up in the filters. Again, basically because they use words that are to do with sex, and those words get you caught up in filters. That's the basic problem. They can only really do this by searching linguistic terms. They're not doing it by looking at websites and working out what they really are.
Well, I noticed with this story last year, Bing, which is the Microsoft search engine, and Google were very quick to comply with David Cameron's request to go along with this filtering process. These big internet companies, Jim, I mean, they are torn, aren't they, between governments that want them to be used as a sort of tool of regulation and surveillance, and the public, who want them to keep their information private and simply to deliver the answers, you know, cleanly and honestly that they are asking of those search engines. So which side are they on? I mean, Microsoft and Google, just as two examples.
Well, I think the problem with the companies is there are different kinds of public and different kind of politicians. And at the moment, the ones who are being listened to most are the politicians who, you know, who are screaming for protecting children from legal pornography or from child abuse images, or child predators, in fact. That's what they're actually trying to target here. And the politicians who are being a bit more sensible, perhaps, you know, different kinds of politicians, and the public, who I think are torn between those of us who are worried about free speech and privacy, who don't want the government surveilling everybody up to the hilt, just on the basis that every now and again they might get some information which might be relevant to some possible crime. You know, that's a different group of people from the people who are being kind of whipped into hysteria by the Daily Mail over, say, children seeing pornography or something like that. And so, really, I think the important thing here is that most people are protective of their own choices, and they do want to decide when they don't want to access material. They want that to be their own decision, not the government's decision, and we have to make that apparent to government. And it's only when the government realizes that they're going to get pushback, and the Daily Mail is not the end all of public opinion, that we're going to win these battles.
Okay, also this week we've seen the Washington Post and the Guardian winning a Pulitzer Prize for their revelations from Edward Snowden. What in your mind is the most significant aspect of that? Because this has been a dominant story, really, through most of the last year. I mean, how significant do you think Snowden is?
Well, I think tremendously, actually. I mean, you know, we simply didn't know the extent of government surveillance. People suspected they may be doing some of what they've turned out to be doing, but I don't think anybody suspected that they'd just be doing everything they possibly could, and which is actually what it appears they're doing. They are constantly trying to innovate around the technology, constantly trying to innovate in ways to find access to materials, to networks, to devices. You know, they are simply not content, it seems, to have any part of the internet untouchable or inaccessible. They don't care who it is, whether it's a government, whether it's individuals or companies. As far as they're concerned, we're all guilty until we're shown not to be. And they should just get everybody's information all of the time on the basis that somebody somewhere will turn out to be guilty. So we better have all of the information all of the time. And that I think, is the crux of what we've learned. You know, whether it's the harvesting off cables, whether it's the breaking of encryption technologies or weakening them, or whether it's finding bugs and not reporting them so the information can be stolen that way, whether it's breaking into private networks at Google or Yahoo, or, you know, sort of fooling system administrators to installing spyware so that their systems can be broken into. You know, whatever method it is, I think it's the underlying picture that these people simply don't think that anyone has any right to privacy, that everything should be gathered, no matter what, without any real compunction about that.
Is there any one revelation that you've seen from Snowden over the last, whatever it is, 8 months or so, that's really shocked you more than any others, Jim?
You know, that's really, really hard to say. I mean, I think that there, if there was one, it was probably what they did with the encryption technologies, because the effect of spending lots of money on making security technology weaker, that means everybody is more vulnerable to criminals. So you take the Heartbleed bug that we learnt about last week. There are people saying, and we don't know, that the NSA and GCHQ may have known about the Heartbleed bug for much longer than the public, you know, a couple of years. Now, if that was true, they've effectively sat on a vulnerability so that they could exploit it, knowing full well that the effect of that would be that criminals would also find out about the same vulnerability and steal people's information, you know, and leave and do whatever criminal activities as a result of that. So that means that the NSA and GCHQ, if this turns out to be true, that would mean that they effectively had prioritized national security over protecting individuals from criminality. And I don't think that's a reasonable balance at all. I don't think there's anything in that that is fair or reasonable. But that's what the whole program of attacking encryption and security means. It means creating vulnerabilities in programs or leaving them there or exploiting them in order to benefit the national security agencies in the name of national security, while meanwhile sacrificing everybody's individual security and protection from criminality. That is just an extraordinary thing to do, because it's spreading risk everywhere without any kind of thought or worry about the fact that those people are going to be damaged. I think that really exposes their thinking, because they're saying national security, or really national security agencies, are more important than your security or my security. I think that's wholly unreasonable.
Okay, now you've got a meeting, I know, in Bristol next Thursday at St Werburgh's Community Centre in the evening. Can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, so our solicitor, Dan Carey, who's putting forward our legal challenge to PRISM, Tempora, and the use of internet surveillance by GCHQ and the government. He's put that case together, and he's going to explain to people come to that meeting what this means. Because we're taking the government to the European Court, and we're currently waiting for various bits of tribunals and processes to conclude, so that can be heard at the European Court. And he'll explain what our aims are in that, what our arguments are, what we're saying about UK law, why we think it's inadequate, and also what will happen if we win. And that is a really interesting thing, actually. I mean, when we find out the result, we should find out how compatible UK law is with European human rights. We think it isn't compatible. And we should force the government, we hope to force the government to legislate. So, you know, to rewrite the laws to make them closer or more compatible with human rights. And that will force a public debate, it'll force a political debate in Parliament, which is what we haven't had. Nobody's ever voted on any of this. Nobody said it was okay to do all this or to steal pictures of people off their webcams or whatever it happened to be. You know, they'll have to justify themselves. So that's why we're doing it. But Dan will be able to explain more about what the results of that are likely to be.
So that's Open Rights Group solicitor Dan Carey, and he'll be at St Werburgh's Community Centre at 8 o'clock next Thursday. That's Thursday the 24th of April. So Jim Killick, Executive Director of ORG, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And that meeting is called Privacy Not PRISM, challenging GCHQ in the European courts. And as you heard there, Thursday, April 24th, that's next Thursday, St Werburgh's Community Centre, Hawley Road, Bristol, starts at 8 p.m. Now, Martin, some of the issues there are really pretty serious, aren't they? That these are our public servants, but it seems that they're more concerned with national security than they are with looking after our privacy. Surely, and again, what we're seeing here is that they believe they have broad powers to put everybody under surveillance without actually going to get a court order.
Well, indeed, and you could argue, and I would argue, that surveying people without court orders is in fact illegal. So everything that they've been doing up to now is in fact illegal.
Yeah, but they will use the excuse, I imagine, well, this is a military matter, it's national security at stake.
No, well, is it not the case? You cannot just say national security is at stake. You've got to, even national security agencies have to operate within the law, and the law allows for that. The existing law, the military are allowed to do certain things which the police aren't allowed to do. but those for only for military purposes, and there's regulations concerning that.
Well, maybe they would argue that this surveillance of the general population is potentially for military purposes.
Well, it is, but there's no legal basis for it, and therefore it's illegal. And if things are illegal, then people who've carried them out should go to prison. If we're going to send people to prison for stealing bottles of water in riots and putting up Facebook pages calling for a riot, which doesn't happen, then those who do these things are going to expect to go to prison. We mentioned Brigadier Gordon Kerr earlier. He ran the loyalist paramilitary terror campaign through the Force Research Unit. All illegal. Terrorism. Terrorists are not just people with beards in caves in Afghanistan. They can have hats and epaulettes and lots of medals on, and they can still be terrorists. And that's why the independent police force should be independent of all of that, answerable to the people through the courts. And that means that they go after everybody who's breaking the law.
But surely, I mean, the civil police don't have jurisdiction. It's the military police that have jurisdiction.
Well, no, I would argue that in certain cases, the civil police should, in fact, deal with military people as terrorists, because they are. What were we talking about, what NATO got up to earlier? Bombing Bologna, bombing Piazza Fontana, possibly shooting people in Kiev. All criminal activity, all of which the police should deal with. Because if the police aren't going to deal with it, then somebody else's military will have to deal with it. Yeah? So the Russian military, or the Provisional IRA, or somebody like that, will have to deal with it.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, Granville Williams is a campaigner with the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. And he is bringing us up to speed now with who owns Britain's media today and how it's all being affected by some of the internet titans like Microsoft, Google and Facebook.
My name's Granville Williams and I'm from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, which is a media reform group concerned to develop policies at a UK and a European level to do with media ownership, media diversity and a more diverse, accountable press.
The thing is, though, Granville, that things are going in the opposite direction. Media generally, right across the Western world particularly, is being consolidated into fewer and fewer hands.
Well, absolutely. You've got two problems. One is the old, what they call now the legacy media, the big media corporations like News Corporation, the giant media corporations in America. Even as we speak, there are moves in America to amalgamate a huge company, a broadband and wireless company, with a television company, and now to accumulate bigger power.
Who are those groups?
Well, the ones that are doing it at the moment, the telephone system, Verizon in America, is the biggest telephone company, and it's seeking to acquire the second biggest telephone company and also the broadband networks that they own as well, the wires. And then they've acquired a few years ago the biggest television company, National Broadcasting Corporation, NBC. And so as a result, you get big media getting bigger. So that's the old problem.
This is also, I mean, what is known as vertical integration, isn't it? Where you've got producers of programmes, news studios, also owning telecommunications network over which that is broadcast. So isn't that fairly new?
It used to be called cross-media ownership. Your broadcasting systems in the UK, for example, the ITV system, you had a number of different companies, and if you mean by that by being independent, so you'd have the area of the UK I live in, Yorkshire Television was an independent ITV company, which is now, of course, disappeared virtually. There's no presence in Leeds where the company used to be. It's part of Britain, in the sense of England and Wales, an ITV company. All of the original 15 franchises in the UK are now owned by three Scottish television. There's one independent in Ulster.
And for us in Bristol, we've had HTV disappear and get consolidated into ITV. But this is what you're saying, a hidden change that's happened actually in a weird way behind the scenes there, is that not only have we lost the independent local ITV broadcasters, but also the distribution of those programmes is now part of the same network that's making the programme.
Exactly. Yorkshire used to have a current affairs programme program maker. It was called First Tuesday. Very excellent, you know, current affairs, investigative journalism. That's gone. In London, Thames Television had This Week. That's gone. In Granada land, they had World in Action. That's gone. What's replaced it is nothing, because there's no requirement when the government, and governments have to do this, when they write off the idea that there should be 15 independent franchises, and so it's okay for you to have one for England and Wales, and that company, of course, immediately gets rid of all of those diverse production companies from the regions, and they will then programme, often from London. There's very little production outside of London in ITV, when the whole point about it was a voice from the regions, for the regions, but also producing programmes that made waves nationally and indeed internationally.
Okay, what about the wider picture though with other forms of media such as internet news providers and radio providers and newspapers? Who are the big owners in Britain? Obviously we know about Rupert Murdoch. How much does he own, for example?
Well, Murdoch's share of the UK national press still is in the low 30s, 30%. If you actually add up the big newspaper groups in the UK, they still have a dominant share. So that News International, the Daily Mail, General Trust Group, and the Telegraph Group, these big media groups still are dominant in terms of the market share.
And to what extent are those newspapers also buying up other forms of media, maybe like book publishing and radio, for example?
Right. Well, again, News International is the UK arm of News Corporation. News Corporation owns one of the biggest book publishing groups in the world, which is HarperCollins. I mean, book publishing is a very interesting example where you've got a number of different groups which are themselves part of bigger media groups, so that there was a big merger of two book publishing groups, Penguin and Random House. Bertelsmann owned Random House, which is a global book publisher, and they've acquired Penguin as well. So there's a giant consolidation there.
So why don't they just call themselves Bertelsmann on the book label?
Well, that's because, well, in print, it's about brands, isn't it? I mean, Penguin still has a recognition value. Anybody of my age, I won't tell you what age I am, but anybody of my age will remember Penguin Books as being a distinctive brand. So you hold on to the brand and you hold on to the titles. Remember, and people will forget this, what is one of the biggest global hits in terms of film? It was The Lord of the Rings. That original book, when it was published, 1,500 copies by one tiny publisher. That publisher is now part of HarperCollins. But HarperCollins has the rights and the ownership of the rights to that book. It's made millions and billions of pounds by being able to exploit those rights, market them, sell them to another global media group, Time Warner. And so if you look at the figures, one book, 1,500 copies printed a few years ago, has transformed into a completely different product, commercialised. Many would say a travesty of the original book in terms of the spirit of that book. But my God, those two global media groups, News Corporation by owning the book, selling the rights to make films with it, have produced huge amounts of revenue. And now they are battling about whether there have been copyright infringements.
Okay, so who are the big media corporation players in Britain today?
The big media corporation players, the BBC is one, but there's an argument about the BBC, because it's a public service broadcaster, its remit, and it's regulated as well. It's required to produce impartial news and a range of other programmes. We can argue, I see you're raising your heads, we're on radio, but you're raising your eyebrows there. The issue of impartial news is quite important, because if you go to America and compare a news programme in the UK with Fox News, you would not recognise that it is news. It's often a booster for a particular Republican cause or attack on Obama. It's not impartial in any way. But the big, just to go back, answer your question, the big other group is still News Corporation, News International, because there was a big battle to stop Rupert Murdoch taking full control of B Sky B. But at the moment, Rupert Murdoch owns 39% of B Sky B. That is effective control.
Surely 51% is effective control.
No. If you own that section of the shares, if the effective decision making stays with you, because you then bring other shareholders who think you're making the right decisions, they will support you in what you're doing. And up to now, B Sky B has been enormously successful, highly profitable, generates far more revenue than the BBC licence fee does. And so people will side with Murdoch and support him in his decisions. Just to make one point, Channel 5 at the moment is up for sale. An appalling decision, if you think back, that Richard Desmond, a pornographer, acquired the Daily Express Group and then was able to purchase Channel 5 for just over £100 million. He's selling it for £800 million.
That was Granville Williams then. We'll have more from him next week. He's from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. He's author of Britain's Media, How They Are Related, Media Ownership and Democracy. That was actually, though, published in 1994, and he's doing an update this year. Like I say, more from him next week. The time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock now. Cyrus the Virus and his typical topical Afro-tropical show are up next. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Labour councillor for Eastville, Vari Threlfall. Thanks also to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times at thisweek.org.uk. And you can follow my Twitter feed in between shows at Tony Gosling, as well as BCFM Radio for the station as a whole. So I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very relaxing and enjoyable rest of the Easter weekend. Do please join us for our Friday drive time politics show at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let those banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the father of a British teenager killed in Syria has described him as a martyr, but he says he tried to convince him not to fight in the war-torn country. 18-year-old Abdullah Degeyes from Brighton is believed to have died earlier this month after leaving the UK in January. His father, Abby Baker, has paid this tribute.
I think he is very brave, although I on the personal level, I that he had a longer life and that he could have done other work rather than fight, you know, like help with aid and relief efforts.
A 7-year-old boy has been taken to hospital in Aberdeen after suffering serious burns. It's understood the incident involved petrol. An eyewitness claims the boy...